This is Jonah Berger, author of Magic Words, What to Say to Get Your Way, and you are listening to the Marketing Book Podcast.
Welcome to the Marketing Book Podcast, helping you keep up with the smartest thinking in the quickly changing field of modern marketing. And now, here's your host, Douglas Burdett.
Hello, thanks for joining me on the Marketing Book Podcast, where each week I publish an interview with the author of a new marketing or sales book, and which has been named as one of the top marketing podcasts by Forbes and LinkedIn, amongst others. Don't worry about taking notes. You can find links to everything linkable in this episode's website page at marketingbookpodcast.com. And since I get to read every book featured on the show, if I can recommend a specific marketing or sales book or any other resource I know of for whatever challenge you're facing, send me a LinkedIn connection invite with a message that you're a listener, and I will do my best to get you pointed in the right direction. This episode is sponsored by Marketing Architects, creators of the all-inclusive TV advertising concept that's so revolutionary, they wrote a book about it. I'll tell you more and how to get a copy of the book in a few minutes. Now, let's get on with the show. Today, we welcome back Jonah Berger for the third time to talk about his book, Magic Words, What to Say to Get Your Way, published by Harper Business. Jonah Berger is a professor at the Wharton School at the University of Pennsylvania, an internationally best-selling author and world-renowned expert on word-of-mouth, social influence, consumer behavior, and how products, ideas, and behaviors catch on. He has published dozens of articles in top-tier academic journals, teaches Wharton's highest-rated online course, and popular accounts of his work often appear in places like the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, and Harvard Business Review. Over a million copies of his three previous books, Contagious, Invisible Influence, and The Catalyst, How to Change Anyone's Mind, are in print in over 35 countries around the world. And interesting fact, one of his very first jobs was as the Easter Bunny at the mall. Dr. Berger, congratulations on Magic Words, and welcome back to the Marketing Book Podcast.
Thanks so much for having me back.
So congratulations on being inducted into the Marketing Book Podcast Three Timers Club. Feel free to add that to your bio.
I will.
For the rest of your life, you will be paying less at Taco Bell. You'll be getting lots of discount coupons for any Taco Bell in the Philadelphia area.
Good to hear.
Yeah. Feel free to share those with your students, too. Now, you were on the show back in 2016 for to talk about Invisible Influence, and then 193 episodes later, you came back and we talked about The Catalyst, and now you're here 157 episodes later. So, Dr. Berger, it looks to me that you're picking up your pace.
I hesitate to say that. This book is actually parts of this book I've been working on for over a decade. And when I came out with The Catalyst, I had toyed with writing this book instead. And I didn't feel like it was completely ready yet. And I was so excited about The Catalyst that I did The Catalyst first. And then once that came out, I started working on this.
Now, for those folks that are longtime Marketing Book Podcast listeners, they know that I have interviewed more authors with Stanford degrees than any other school. And I don't know why that is. Maybe it's the biggest school in the world. Maybe they require it on the application. But you were an undergrad at Stanford. You got your PhD there. And by marketing podcast law, I'm required to play this song. But you are a professor at Wharton, and I've interviewed one of your colleagues twice now, Peter Fader.
Yes. Great guy.
Yeah. So when you're walking by his office now, you've been on three times, he's been on twice, you can talk some smack to him, although I know he's got another book coming out. But I've also interviewed a lot of graduates, as well as some lecturers there, like Neil Hoyne and Robert Chen. It's amazing. And a lot of listeners, they all seem to come out of the woodwork. So I appreciate you doing that. And I do have to mention that in this book, Magic Words, you have a section on how to ask better questions, which makes me so nervous about interviewing you. And a few years ago, I interviewed the legendary CNN correspondent Frank Sesno about his book, Ask More, which is about how to ask questions. It's a similar situation. And you also write about the use of ums and uhs when speaking. So right off the bat, I'd like to apologize for that in advance. But I just want to read from a couple sections at the beginning of the book and get into a couple of the key ideas, a couple of the magic words, if you will. On page 2, you write, almost everything we do involves words. We use words to communicate ideas, express ourselves, and connect with loved ones. They're how leaders lead, salespeople sell, and parents parent. They're how teachers teach, policymakers govern, and doctors explain. Even our private thoughts rely on language. By some estimates, we use around 16,000 words a day. We write emails, build presentations, and talk to friends, colleagues, and clients. We draft online dating profiles, chat with neighbors, and touch base with partners to see how their day went. But while we spend a lot of time using language, we rarely think about the specific language we use. Sure, we might think about the ideas we want to communicate, but we think a lot less about the particular words we use to communicate them. And why should we? Individual words often seem interchangeable. And you go on to write, but it turns out that intuition is wrong, very wrong. And on page 8, you write, this book uncovers the hidden science behind how language works, and more important, how we can use it more effectively to persuade others, deepen relationships, and be more successful at home and work. And for all those listeners, I just want to quote about how relevant this is to your life and work and success from page 12, where you write, whether we realize it or not, we're all writers. We may not write books or news articles or call ourselves authors or journalists, but we still write. We write emails to colleagues and text to friends. We write reports for bosses and draft slide decks for clients. We're also all public speakers. We may not go on stage in front of thousands of people, but we all speak in public. Whether making presentations to the company or chit-chatting on a first date, we ask donors to make a pledge or asking the kids to clean up their rooms. But to be better writers and speakers, to communicate with intention and care, we have to know the right words to use. It's hard to get people to listen, to pay attention, to persuade them to do what we want. And it's hard to motivate others, encourage creativity, and build social connections. But the right words can help. It's often said that certain people have a way with words. They're persuasive and charismatic, and it seems as though they always know the right thing to say. But are the rest of us who weren't born that way out of luck? Not quite. Because being a great writer or orator isn't something you're born with. It's something you can learn to do. Words have an amazing impact, and by understanding them, why and how they work, we can use them to increase ours. Whether you want to use language more effectively or just understand how it works, this book will show you how. Now, Dr. Berger, I am the king of stupid questions because, like Forrest Gump,
I'm not a smart man.
But on page 5, you write, the language used in earnings calls influences company's stock price, and the language used by CEOs impacts investment returns. How do we know this?
You know, what's really exciting, we've been using language for a long time. Language is not new, right? And our use of language is not new. But two things have changed over the past few decades. First is that more and more of the language we use is being recorded, captured in some way. You and I are talking right now. If 20 years ago you and I had talked on the phone, there'd be no way to capture it. Even if we had recorded it some way over the phone, which would have been challenging, we'd still have to have someone manually transcribe it. Whereas now, with most online things like this, we can capture it and have it automatically transcribed right away. Our emails capture the language we use to talk to colleagues at work. Our social media posts capture our attitudes towards products, brands, services, and experiences. Movie scripts are now out there. Song lyrics are posted online. There's more and more language data out there capturing our attitudes, our opinions, what we are saying, even big repositories of resumes that people have submitted. But second, there are more tools to analyze this data, right? Let's say, 50 years ago, I wanted to analyze what people said to one another at the office and how it impacted whether they got promoted or fired. Well, I'd have to walk around with a microphone. Everyone would have to have a microphone. I'd record them on tapes. I'd then have to transcribe what they said, and I'd have to sift through it all to link it to some outcome. Now, researchers can take emails that are out there that have been passed back and forth between members of a company, as I talk about in one of the studies in the book, and can analyze it, can use natural language processing or automatic tools to extract the language that's being used and correlate that with the outcome. And so not only do we have the data, but now we have the tools to analyze this data. And so I would describe this almost as the new science of language. Right, just like the telescope revolutionized astronomy, just like the microscope revolutionized chemistry, we now have new tools and new data that allow us to understand language better. And so again, language is not new, but now we can understand more things about language because of the availability of data and tools.
Yes, and it brings to mind a book that was on the show recently, The Jolt Effect by Matt Dixon, and they analyzed like 2.5 million sales calls that were recorded during the lockdown, and then overlaid that with who were the most successful sellers, and they found all these similar trends. So reading about how you all did this brought that to mind. It really is opening a new era in being able to study these things. So in chapter one, you write that the difference between a noun and a verb is powerful. Explain what you mean.
Yeah. So first of all, let's ignore nouns and verbs for a minute, because the first time I thought about writing up this research, I said, my God, I'm not even sure I know what a noun is, and I'm not even sure I know what a verb is. And so most people, some of us, your listeners, may go, oh yeah, I know exactly what a noun is, I know what a verb is, and others might go, I'm not entirely sure. But I think an easy way to think about it is the following. You know, we're often trying to get other people to do something. If we're a salesperson, we're trying to turn prospects into clients. If we're a leader, we're trying to get employees to, you know, do what we're asking them to do. If we're a parent, we're trying to get our kids to do something. If we're a teacher, if we're a politician, whatever it might be, we're often trying to get others to do things. And often when we do that, we take a particular strategy. We might ask someone for help, for instance, if we want help with something, or if we're a nonprofit, we're trying to get voters to turn out, we might ask someone to vote. But it turns out a subtle shift in the way we use language, only one, if not two letters, can have a big impact on whether people do what we want. And so there was a study that was done at Stanford University a number of decades ago now, where they had students in a classroom. These were elementary school students, little kids, and the classroom was a mess. There were crayons everywhere, there were books that were out, a bunch of stuff had spilled, and they needed help cleaning up the classroom. And so for some of the students, they used the traditional approach. They said, hey, can you help clean up? They used help, which is a verb, to encourage the students to clean up. But for the other half of students, they tried something subtly but importantly different. They said, can you be a helper? And clean up. Now, the difference between help and helper, I don't have to tell you, is infinitesimally small, right? Add the letters ER to the end of that word. They're basically the same word. Yet it had a big difference on whether the students actually did what they were asked to do. If they were asked to be a helper, they were 30% more likely to help clean up the class. And that's an interesting example, but you might say, well, that's with kids, you know, does it really apply to adults and in a consequential setting? Well, in another study, more recently published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Science, they looked at applying this to voting. So they reached out to a bunch of people who were potential voters. And for some people, they used the traditional approach that we often use when we are asking people to vote. They basically said, hey, please vote, right? They use a verb, vote, to ask them what to do. But for another set of people, a second group of people in this experiment, they asked a very slightly different approach. In this case, they only changed one letter. Rather than asking someone to vote, they asked them to be a voter, right? Will you be a voter and turn out and vote? And again, this is only one letter difference, very, very small. Yet it led to about a 15% increase in the percentage of people that voted. And so help to helper, vote to voter, these seem quite small. Why did they work? Well, the reason why is that we're all busy. We have lots of stuff that we wish we could do, but we don't always have time to do it. We know we should vote, we know we should help, but we don't always have the time. But what's more important to us than just taking actions is holding desirable identities, right? We want to see ourselves as smart and efficacious and competent and athletic and good people. And so we want to do things that allow us to hold those identities, to believe we are those type of people. And sure, helping is a good thing, but being a helper, well, if helping becomes an opportunity to be a helper, now I'm much more likely to do it. Similarly, voting, yeah, sure, that's great. But if voting gives me an opportunity to be a voter, to see myself as a voter, well, now I'm much more likely to do it. And the same actually holds on the negative side, but in the opposite direction, right? Cheating is bad. Being a cheater is even worse. Losing is bad. Being a loser is even worse. And so research finds that, you know, if the act of cheating would make someone a cheater, they're less likely to do it. And so I call this turning actions into identities, right? Rather than asking people to help, ask them to be a helper. Rather than asking them to vote, ask them to be a voter. Rather than asking them to lead, ask them to be a leader, right? Subtly changing what we're doing, making it instead of an action, making it an identity, will make people more likely to do it.
Right. You're right. Framing actions as opportunities to confirm desired identities will encourage people to go along. And I can remember my sister-in-law and my brother, they were always saying to their kids, like, Mitchell, he's the helping person. And now I realize what they were doing. I don't know if they were conscious of that. But one other thing in the book is that I have a lot of issues, Dr. Berger, and perhaps if you were a professor of psychology, we could work through some of them. But I often talk to myself out loud, and it really bothers my wife. And she'll often be in another room, and she'll say, "Are you talking to yourself again?" And now I say, "Yes," and you're interrupting the conversation. But it still troubles her, poor woman. But in your book, you said it's okay to talk to yourself, and I show that to her, so I appreciate that. Explain how you're helping.
Yeah. So let me just say one more thing about actions to identities, and then I'll turn to this other piece. I think many of us have not just with things we want others to do, but things we want ourselves to do, mm-hmm. and we can use that same trick of action to identities on ourselves, right? So imagine I told you about two people. One of them runs, and one of them is a runner. Who would you say runs more often?
Oh, the runner. It's a runner. Part of their identity.
Right? It's an identity. It's a stable trait, yeah. Right? Someone who drinks coffee, yeah, they drink coffee once in a while. A coffee drinker, that's who they are, right? If they're a dog lover, that's who they are. If they love dogs, well, that's just, you know, one thing, but it's not as consistent. So if we want to change our own behavior, start talking about ourselves as holding these desired identities rather than having traits. We can think about the same thing even on resumes, right? We often describe ourselves as hardworking or creative, mm-hmm. right? But if we describe ourselves as a hard worker, now it seems much more stable. It's not going to disappear, right? If I say I'm a creator rather than creative, it seems like a stable aspect of my personality. Same with describing other people, right? When we describe them as being an innovator, it seems much more permanent than describing them as innovative. And so we can not only get others to do things, but also make ourselves more likely to do things and make others look better by using this idea of actions and identities. But you had asked about talking to ourselves. And so I think that's a really interesting example of this broader principle that we're talking about here. And so the book talks about six types of language. There are six key types of magic words that we can use across all areas of our life. And I love frameworks, so I put them in a framework, and that is the Speak framework, SPEACC. The S is for similarity. The P is for posing questions. The A is for agency and identity, which is what we're talking about now. Mm-hmm. The E is for emotion. The A is for agency and identity. One of the C's is for confidence, and the other C is for concreteness. And so the bucket we're talking about here is agency and identity. Language not only shares information, but language suggests who is in charge, who is responsible, what it means to engage a particular action. And so by using, as we just talked about, turning actions into identities, that's one way to shift behavior. Another, as you talked about, though, is to talk about ourselves in third person. And what does that mean? Well, often when we're dealing with a difficult situation, we feel really anxious. We're really close to the situation. We can't get it out of our head. You got a tough presentation coming up. Is everybody going to like it? Am I going to talk for too long? Is this going to work? You know, I've never presented this material before. What if I look bad? All of these negative thoughts. And if you notice, even the words I use, what if I look bad? Right? Mm-hmm. Is there enough time for me to talk about things? I'm using first person because I'm talking about myself, as we often do. If we were talking to someone else, though, what would we say? We'd say, well, you're going to be fine. You're going to do a great job. You always do a great job. It's not going to be a problem. And so we use, in that case, second person language, you is, to talk to this other person. It distances us. We are distant from the situation, and it distances us from the situation. And so we're not as worried, right? We can see it from an outsider and help that person get better. And it turns out that we can apply that insight ourselves. So some very nice research. Put people in a situation where they're giving a speech, very tough speech, right? You have 5 minutes to prepare this speech. It's really important. It's going to help you get this outcome that you care about. Not surprisingly, people are very nervous. And while they're preparing the speech, though, they ask them to do one of two general things. One is just talk to yourself like you usually would. And another is talk to yourself like an outsider would, right? So don't say, hey, oh my God, am I going to do okay? But, you know, if you were giving advice to someone else, what would you say? You might say, Jonah, it's going to be fine, right? Jonah, you're going to do a great job. Mm-hmm. You know, you can do it, Jonah, whatever it might be. And what they find is that taking this outsider perspective, talking to yourself in third person or like an outsider would, makes you much less anxious and makes you deliver a better presentation as a result, because now you're distancing yourself from that negative emotion. It's no longer about you. This relates to that idea of identity and agency again, right? It's no longer about you. It's you helping someone else, and that makes it easier to reduce that negative reaction and perform better as a result.
Right, and just like the seemingly minor difference between help and helper, talking to yourself in the third person seems like a small difference, but it's the impact can be enormous. TV advertising is a powerful channel for business growth, and it's a counterintuitive solution for businesses frustrated by the rising costs of digital marketing. But the traditional process for launching TV campaigns is expensive, time-consuming, and complex. That's why marketing architects flip the traditional process on its head. With all-inclusive TV advertising, they invest their own money to produce, analyze, and optimize your TV campaign. All you pay for is media, setting you up for rapid growth at a significant cost advantage. This approach to TV is so revolutionary, they wrote a book about it. It's called All-Inclusive TV, How Booming Brands Are Reimagining TV Advertising. It explores how a variety of brands are using TV to transform their businesses and how you can do the same. For a copy of the book, visit this episode's website page at marketingbookpodcast.com or visit marketingarchitects.com/book and tell them you heard about it on the Marketing Book Podcast. Now, you mentioned confidence. Four ways, you talk about ways to speak with confidence, and you explain that listeners are more persuaded when communicators seem more certain or confident about what they're communicating. What words can help you seem more certain or confident, and what are the words that hinder someone who is certain and confident?
Yeah, and this is getting into a different chapter of the book, and each chapter sort of has, you know, a main idea. We just talked about identity and agency, and then there's sort of, you know, 4 to 6 ways we can apply those ideas.
Right.
We just talked about turning actions into identities. We talked about sort of distancing language, and there are a couple of others about, you know, accusatory yous and the value of you and gaining attention and a variety of other things. Another chapter is about conveying confidence, if you look at people that other people tend to listen to, they're often very charismatic, right? You know, when they open their mouths, everybody listens. And so one question is why, right? What do these people do that makes everybody listen to them? And if you know, I don't want to get into politics here, but one person in particular who recently has gotten a lot of attention for the way they talk is Donald Trump. And whether you like him or not, you can't deny that he's been pretty good at selling his ideas, right? If you hate him, you would say those ideas are terrible. And if you love him, you would say those ideas are great. But regardless, he's done a good job of selling them. And so even if you hate him and what he stands for, it's still valuable to understand why he's so successful. And if you love him, I think it's still valuable to understand why he's successful. And so when he sort of announced his presidential campaign, he said something along the lines of the following, you know, I'm going to build a great wall, and nobody builds walls better than me. Believe me, I'll build them very inexpensively. You know, our country is in serious trouble. We don't have victories anymore. We used to have victories, but we don't have them anymore. When was the last time anybody saw us beating like China, you know, in a trade deal? I beat China all the time. And not surprisingly, and this is a great example of speaking versus writing, by the way, because when you look at the words on the page, you go, well, what? I mean, this is sort of simplistic. This is empty. You know, other people called it pure bluster. And yet, less than a year later, he's elected the president of the United States. And so something he's doing, whether you like him or hate him, is working. What is it? And if you look closer, he's actually doing the exact same thing that startup founders that get a lot of attention, the Steve Jobs and the Elon Musks of the world, gurus and others often do. And all these individuals who people pay attention to and people listen to often speak with a great deal of certainty. And what do I mean by certainty, right? Well, something will definitely happen. This is obvious. The course of action is clear. Everyone agrees. This is guaranteed to work. Everyone agrees with me. It's undeniable. It's obvious. It's essential. It's unquestionable. They speak like things are definite, like this will definitely happen. Mm-hmm. And not surprisingly, that makes people more likely to listen. There was a study that was done a few years ago with financial advisors. And so people listened to a couple different financial advisors, one who spoke with more certainty and one who spoke with less, right? One who said, this stock is definitely going to go up or is, 95% chance of going up, and another that was a little bit more tentative. And they found that people preferred the advisor that was more certain, even when that person was not more right. So it wasn't that they were actually more accurate. They were not more accurate. They were equally accurate. In some cases, they even seemed overconfident. When they were wrong, they were more overconfident in their wrongness, yet people still preferred them. And the reason why is that if someone speaks with certainty, right, you go, well, what they're saying has to be true, because if they're so sure of it, right, then they're probably right. And notice, though, the difference between certainty and the way most of us talk. And I'm an academic, so I'm as guilty of this as anybody. But when I work with consulting clients or I work with companies and organizations, they'll often say, what do you think about this strategy? Or do you think this is going to work? And I'll often say something like, yeah, I think that'll work. Or, that might work. Or this is probably a good course of action. Or, I think this seems like a good approach. And notice what I'm doing there, using words like seems, might, possibly, probably, could. I think, seems to me, could. Mm-hmm. All of those are examples of what are called hedges. And we use hedges all the time. I use them. You probably use them. All our listeners use them. They're a verbal tick we do when we're not sure about something. And I'm not saying never to hedge. But here's the problem. The more we hedge, the less likely people are to do what we're suggesting. Right? When we say something might work, something's probably the case, it could, then people say, well, no thanks, I'm not going to do it. Right? Research we conducted, we've done dozens of studies in this space and looked at online reviews, and people are less likely to follow someone's advice the more that person uses hedges. And the reason why is because hedgers seem less confident, less mm-hmm. certain. Right? If I seem less certain, well, other people are less likely to listen to me. And so the first, I think, piece of guidance from this, I think there are at least three. The first is ditch the hedges, right? Yes, if you are trying to hedge on purpose for a reason, that's fine. But if you're just doing it because it's a verbal tick, just like ums and uhs and fillers and non-fluencies, try to ditch the hedges because you're undermining your own impact, right, by doing so. Second, right, there are certain hedges that are going to be more effective than others. So if I say, it seems like this will work, versus I say, it seems to me like this might work. I think this will happen versus this might happen. I can either connect these things to myself, seems to me, or make them general. And our research shows that when you make it about you, seems to me, I think this, in my opinion this, other people are more likely to take your advice. And the reason why is that you seem more certain. You seem more confident. You're willing to stand behind it. It's not just uncertainty out there. You're willing to own that uncertainty. And so other people are more likely to listen. So if we're going to hedge, let's use those hedges that give us personal ownership of it. But then the third thing is be a little bit more circumspect and identify the uncertainty. I could say, hey, I don't know if this is going to work because I don't, right? There is uncertainty. I don't know if this is going to work. I also could say, I think this is a great strategy, but for this to work, we need to do these three things. Now, I sound really certain there, right? I'm not sure whether we'll be able to do those three things. That's where the uncertainty was in the first place. I wasn't sure it was going to work because I wasn't sure we could do the three things. But if I'm identifying the uncertainty and calling it out, for this to work, we need to do these three things. Well, now I seem really certain. Right? I am uncertain that it will work, but I'm not uncertain about what we need to do to get there. And so other people are more likely to listen as a result.
Right. And it's less about you. You're pointing out where the uncertainty might be.
But you're also, you're indicating you are certain. You are certain mm-hmm. about where the uncertainty is, right? It's not unknowable. It's actually pretty knowable if we can do these things. Now, we may not be able to do those things, but it's being clear that you're not completely uncertain. There, you have more certainty than you're letting on.
And one other thing from that chapter I found interesting is to turn past tense into present tense. In other words, use the present tense to communicate confidence and increase persuasion. Like, instead of saying, I loved your book, you should say, I love your book.
Yeah. I mean, so imagine you're in the office one day and somebody comes up to you. There's a job candidate that comes in. They give a presentation or have an interview. And someone goes, what did you think? Right. A couple of days later, you could say, well, it seemed like they're good. Or it seems like they're good, right? I liked them, or I like them. That's a very subtle difference, right? In both cases, you're indicating you have favorable attitudes towards the person. But in one case, you're using the past tense, I liked them, they seemed good. In the other case, you're using the present tense, I like them, they seem good. Same thing with the beach, right? The beach was beautiful, the beach is beautiful. The hotel had good food, the hotel has good food. You can use past tense or present tense to talk about the same thing. We did analysis of hundreds of thousands of online reviews, as well as a variety of experiments, and we found that present tense increases persuasion. And the reason why is that the speaker seems more confident, right? If you said the beach was good, it suggests that yes, at a certain point in time when you went, you had an experience that was good. If you say the beach is good, you are making an assertion. Not only was it good for me when I went, but it is still good. It will be good in the future, and you were likely to have a good time there. And so by using present tense, we are indicating our confidence in what we're saying, which makes other people more likely to listen. And so again, if we want someone, whether we're pitching something in a sale, or talking to a person in an organization, or even in our home lives, if we want people to listen to us, let's use that present tense rather than that past tense, right? There are times where we have to say something happened in the past, right? I studied, or I made lunch, right? If I made it already, I made it. It happened in the past. But right. Particularly with our attitudes towards something, we can use past or present. And if we use present, people will be more likely to listen.
Well, in our remaining time, let me just ask you about two things you mentioned, questions as well as concreteness. So, Dr. Berger, can I ask your advice on something?
Sure.
See what I did there? What are some strategies for asking better questions?
You know, I love questions, and questions is not it has not originally been my main area of research, but I've talked about questions now over a few books, and the more I learn about questions, the more research I do on questions, the more research I read that others have done on questions, they're really powerful linguistic devices, right? Questions don't just allow us to collect information. They shape how we're perceived. They shape how we perceived others. They shape our ability to build social connections. Questions really do a lot of work. They shine attention on things in conversations. And so there's a lot we can do with this this linguistic device. And one thing you just alluded to, and in the book I talk about four or five aspects of questions, but one you just alluded to is asking for advice. And I think most of us are reticent to ask for advice. Mm-hmm. If we're stuck on a tough problem, we're dealing with something we can't figure out how to resolve, you know, we want to ask somebody else, but we're sitting there going, well, you know, I don't know if they'll know the answer. Even if they do know the answer, I'll probably be bothering them. And even worse, you know, maybe they'll think worse of me as a result, right? They'll think I'm not very smart. They'll think I don't know what I'm talking about. They'll perceive me negatively. And so, you know what? I'll just skip it. I
won't. Idiot!
And that's a mistake, because research has actually looked at this. Research has had people have conversations, and in those conversations, some people ask for advice and some don't. And what they find is that people that ask for advice are perceived as better, not worse.
Yes.
Are perceived as more competent, not less competent. Perceived as more intelligent, not less intelligent. And the reason why, very simply, is that all of us are super self-centered. We're all egocentric. All of us think we give great advice. Right? We all think our opinions are good, regardless of what job we have or organization. We're like, yeah, my opinions are pretty good. And so if someone else comes around and asks us for our opinions, we go, well, they must be pretty smart, right? Because they're smart enough to ask me for advice. And so advice is not a bad thing to ask for. It actually makes us perceived better, makes us other people think we're smarter, not less smart. But it's not just about advice, right? There's different types of questions that I talk about in the book. And another type is follow-up questions.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, often in conversation, to be polite, you know, someone will say, how are you? And you say, good, how are you? That's a, you know, an introductory type question. Or someone will come back from a presentation, what'd you think of the talk? I thought it was pretty good. What'd you think? We use those conversations as a way of being polite, those questions as a way of being polite, and that's fine. But when researchers looked at thousands of conversations, they found that there was a particular type of question that led others to like us more. people asked these type of questions were liked more. In a dating context, people were more likely to want to go on a date with them. In an organizational context, they were perceived better. And these questions are called follow-up questions, right? And you do a great job of asking these as an interviewer. But you know, when someone says something, oh yeah, I found that presentation interesting, don't just say, yeah, I did as well. Say, oh, what did you find interesting about it? Mm-hmm. Right? I'm following up what you said with a question. Or a spouse comes home and says, oh man, I had a really tough day. Not just saying, oh, I'm so sorry to hear that, which is nice also, but saying, oh wow, why was it so difficult? Follow-up questions show we listened, we understood, and we care enough to answer, to be responsive. And as a result, they make people like us more.
Oh, so interesting. And don't tell the other chapters, but chapter 4 was my favorite, about asking the right questions. So interesting and so relevant to all the salespeople listening. Let me just ask one question I think they would like is, how do you get people to divulge negative information, even when it might put them at a disadvantage?
Yeah, I mean, I think this is a strategy that's a little bit more complicated, but it is super important. And so, you know, often we ask questions in a way that kind of allows people to wiggle out of the question, right? So if we said, you know, we're buying a used item and we say something like, oh, you know, there's no problems with this, are there? Right? And so that's a question. And then someone could tell us the truth, and they're probably going to tell us the truth, but it makes it really easy for them not to tell us the truth, right? The question basically presupposes that there are no problems. And so when we use, they're called negative assumption questions, mm-hmm. It's really easy for people just to say no, right? Similarly, at the doctor's office, you know, a doctor seeing multiple patients a day, you know, you haven't been smoking, have you? You haven't been drinking too much, have you? You're eating healthy, right? You're eating your vitamins, right?
Right.
It's really easy to say, yeah, of course, because the question sets it up in a way that lets you out of it, right? But there are other questions that are going to be more effective, right? Questions like, what problem does the used item have? Right? What problems does it have? Someone can still say no. But now they're really, it's really hard for them to say no, right? Because they're going to feel more bad about it. It indicates that, hey, I'm not aware of the issues. I'm interested in the issues, and I want to find out more of them if they're out there. I think about the same thing often as a teacher often. You know, teachers usually at the end of classes think, are there any questions? Mm-hmm. Right? Or does anybody have any questions? And that's a hard thing to do as a student, to raise your hand. It kind of sets it up like, well, there aren't any questions, but if you have one, go ahead. A different way that I've seen someone do that's really nice is, what questions do you have? Well, hold on. Now it's clear. I really want to know that people have, I'm not just being polite. I really want to know what questions people have. And now it's going to encourage people to be more likely to ask a question, because it's forcing them to think, okay, well, what questions do I have? And people are more likely to ask them. And so a subtle shift in kind of how we frame questions can make other people more likely to divulge information, because rather than sort of assuming that there's no problem or assuming something else, it sets up the assumption to go the other direction.
That's the negative assumption questions.
Yes.
Right. You're right. They reveal information about our knowledge, our assumptions, and even how assertive we're going to be. They shape how we are perceived and the truthfulness of the answers we receive. I just thought it was fascinating. So
yeah, I mean, I love that, you know, that negotiation. What problems does it have? Oh, if they start with that question,
it doesn't have any
problems, doesn't it? But if they start, what problems does it have? I go, well, man, I can say something, but this person's serious. And so I might as well just tell them now rather than sort of get into a long discussion and have to tell them later, right? It's clear they are dialed in. They want a truthful answer. And so I'm not going to be able to get out of it as easily.
Right. I think anyone who's going to buy something, which is approximately 100% of the listening audience, should read this chapter about what to ask when someone's selling to you as well. So the last thing I want to ask you about, you mentioned it earlier, explain the concept of linguistic concreteness and how you mix that together.
Sure. Yeah. You know, I'll tell you, to talk about linguistic concreteness, I'll tell you a little bit of a story. And so a few years ago, I was in Dallas, working with a consulting client, and going on my way back to the airport. And when I get the text message that sort of all travelers dread, right? Your flight has been delayed. Mm. Whatever it might be, you're not going to be able to make the original flight. And so I call customer service, have a super frustrating experience, as is often the case.
Even though your call was important to them?
Yeah, even though the call is important to them, right? This is what I love about customer service. They clearly want to show that they care. They know that they should care. Your call is important to you after you've been on hold for 40 minutes, right? So they don't always want to do the work of caring, but they want you to think that they care. And same experience I had, right? Frustrating experience, get off the call. My very nice Uber driver goes, "Oh, you sound really frustrated." I said, "Yeah, you know, I had this difficult customer service experience." He's like, "Oh, you know, my daughter's a customer service agent and she loves it. In fact, she's so good at it that now she trains other people at the organization." And I'm sitting there going, I mean, first of all, this must be a difficult job, but if it isn't for her, what is she doing?
Amazing.
Makes it work, right?
Yeah,
right?
But
also what language is she using, right? Uh-huh. Because here's the thing. Yeah, when I call the airline, I'd love them to, you know, put me on a direct flight that leaves at the same time. If my bag is lost, I'd love them to find it. I'd love all the problems to be solved. But controlling for that, because sometimes that ability is fixed. What about the language they can use? What about the words they say? And so we analyzed hundreds of customer service calls from an airline, from a large online retailer, a number of different organizations. And we found even controlling for solving the problem and all those other things, there's a type of language that agents can use that lead to greater customer satisfaction, actually lead people to buy more as a result, right? And what is that type of language? It's linguistic concreteness. It's using concrete language. And let me use a concrete example to make that concrete. You can say something like, so I'm calling in, I'm saying, "Oh, hey, you know, I need help rebooking my flight." And they could say, "I'll help you with that." Or they could say, "Let me see when the next flight to Philadelphia is," right? The first thing I can help with that is kind of Swiss Army language, right? You can mm-hmm. say, "I can help with that when someone calls about a lost bag, a delayed flight, anything at all." It basically works. But while it's easy for you, the speaker, it doesn't show the listener that you heard them, right? All it does is say, you're saying you can help with that, but it doesn't really mean anything. Whereas when the person says, "You know, I'll look at rebooking you on the next flight to Philadelphia," it's really clear that they heard you, right? And so what we find is that concrete language improves customer satisfaction and leads people to purchase more because it shows listening. And we talked about listening a little bit before, but listening is quite interesting, right? We think about, well, what do you mean by showing listening, right? Don't we want to tell people we listen? But you need to show people because it's not just about hearing what was said. That's the start, right? Next is understanding what was said. But even if you heard and understand what someone said, you have to show them that you heard and understood. And language is one way to do that, right? You can do it with body language also by shaking your head, yes, but language is a great way to show it by using words that show that you heard and understood. And that's exactly what concrete language does, right? And this is true in a variety of different settings. It's not just true in customer service. If you're a salesperson, rather than talking about a car as beautiful, talking about it as cherry red makes it really concrete what that attribute is, right? Mm-hmm. I can touch, I can see cherry red, I can't see beautiful. And so concrete language are things we can touch, feel, smell, interact with in a way that's very visceral. And so using concrete language helps people understand things. It helps them feel like you're listening and makes them more likely to take a desired action as a result.
Why don't we use it more often?
Yeah, you know, I think the challenge is that we feel like concrete language is effortful. Right, we feel, going back to that customer service example, it's easier to use the exact same language every time someone calls. As a leader or a manager, it's easier when you have back-to-back-to-back performance reviews with people to say basically the same thing to each person, right? It's easier, but it's less effective. It's less likely to work, less likely to have the benefits that we want. And so we need to be careful. Sometimes we conceptualize it as speakers, as these high-level things. But as listeners, we all benefit from concrete details. And so we need to think as listeners and use that to guide the language that we use.
Well, Jonah, if readers took only one thing away from the book, what would you hope it would be?
In writing this book, I've thought a lot about language. And as we talked about in the beginning of the call, you know, we use language all the time, whether we're speaking, whether we're writing, whether we're at the office, whether we're at home, whether we're pitching a client, talking to colleagues. Language is what it determines whether we get the outcomes that we want, right? Whether we convince clients, whether we engage audiences, whether we build social connections. Yet we often don't think about the words that we're using. And there's lots of books out there on, you know, seven things to say this or that, that actually haven't been backed up by research. We've now learned enough, given all the data that's out there, actually research-driven insights of how to use language. And so the right words can have a powerful impact in every aspect of our life. If we understand the power of magic words, we can use them more effectively.
Yes. Don't be fooled by what seems like subtle differences.
Yeah.
So what's one thing a listener could do today to put in action an idea from the book that we've talked about to, you know, get them thinking about it until the book arrives?
Yeah, I mean, just that we started with that idea of turning actions into identities, right? When you mm-hmm. want someone to do something, how can you use an identity as a way of driving them to take that action? There's another insight from that chapter about could versus should, right? Often when we're stuck on a tough problem, we think about what we should do. Well, change just one word. What could we do helps us think about more creative solutions and reach a better outcome. And so lots of simple tips and tricks to apply the ideas.
Yes, and there are so many things in the book, obviously, about how to influence others, but there are quite a few, as you just touched on, about how to influence ourselves.
Yes.
For the better. So I see what you did there. That tingling means it's working. So are there any recent or upcoming books that you recommend or looking forward to reading?
Oh God, it's so hard. There's so many great books
out
there.
Just stroll down the your office at Wharton.
You know, I love anything by Dan Pink. I love anything by Charles Duhigg. I love anything by the Heath brothers. You know, anytime those folks come out with something, I'm always excited to read it.
Oh, great. And it's almost like just go ahead and set up. I don't know if you can do this on Amazon. When they write another book, just go ahead and send it because you know it's going to be good. Yeah.
You know it's going to be good.
So great. Well, at marketingbookpodcast.com, we're going to include links to everything linkable, including all the books that have been mentioned, your site, your LinkedIn profile, your Twitter account. And I hope everyone will reach out to you and thank you for being a guest on the Marketing Book Podcast. Congratulate Dr. Berger on not just writing this book, but becoming a member of the Marketing Book Podcast Three Timers Club. And if you're listening on your smartphone and you've subscribed to the Marketing Book Podcast on your favorite app like Spotify or Apple Podcasts, all these links can be found by going to this episode right now and clicking on this episode's website link. Final quote from page 214. As we've shown throughout the book, the right words used at the right time can have immense power. They can help us persuade colleagues and customers, engage audiences and acquaintances, and connect with partners and peers. But while the impact of these words may seem magical, we don't have to be a magician to use them. Indeed, rather than being a spell or some black box of undetermined origin, these words work by leveraging the science of human behavior. By understanding how magic words work, anyone can harness their power. The book is Magic Words, What to Say to Get Your Way. The author is Jonah Berger. Jonah, thank you very much for returning to the Marketing Book Podcast.
Thanks so much for having me.
And that closes the book on another episode of the Marketing Book Podcast. I hope you enjoyed it and found it helpful. Special thanks to this episode's sponsor, Marketing Architects, creators of the all-inclusive TV advertising concept that's so revolutionary, they wrote a book about it. For a copy of the book, All-Inclusive TV, How Booming Brands Are Reimagining TV Advertising, visit this episode's website page at marketingbookpodcast.com or visit marketingarchitects.com/book and tell them you heard about it on the Marketing Book Podcast. And if you are one of the legions of listeners who have left an iTunes review, please let me return your kind favor by mailing you some Marketing Book Podcast stuff. Just send me your mailing address anywhere in the world and I'll drop it in the mail. And remember the words of the late, great Jim Rohn, who said, "Formal education will make you a living. Self-education will make you a fortune."